Crossing Borders, writing for young adults. I was actually crossing the Azad-Kashmir border on an Asia Link fellowship when the idea to write the young adult novel Marrying a Mirror was given to me. My husband and I had hired a flea-infested taxi with an English couple as the border was open due to a recent earthquake. And just as we were crossing the border, the lady said, "Oh, we know the guy from the British embassy who coordinates the forced marriage unit in Islamabad." And I just stared at her in shock. And she said, "Oh, yes," she said, "they make the run up here to Kashmir every week. They rescue 100 British Pakistani brides a year." And I could see it all in an instant. A 16-year-old Australian girl with a Pakistani father and an Australian mum, and how she would become interested in an unsuitable boy, and a father would send her to Azad Kashmir for a wedding she knew nothing of. And rarely does that initial creative inspiration hit me so hard or so clearly. You can still hear me, can't you? Yeah, okay. But as writers, we cross so many borders. Maybe the most obvious one for we three is that boundary of age. Writing about characters who the publishing industry calls young adult. Malcolm, perhaps, I think, might talk about this in more detail, but just for the purposes of my talk here, I see the lower end of young adult writing as 11 to 14 years, because that's the age of a lot of the kids who are actually reading this this literature. But now there is more of an older group, the 14 to 18, and some people like Mark Aronson, a researcher, divides it as 12 to 15 and 15 to 18. And then there are the books that cross over into the adult market and are marketed into both. And recently I was in contact with a researcher that some of you know, Sam Fransway. Thank you, Ruth and Ben. And he suggests it may even be better to classify young adult, pardon me, by the content rather than by age levels. Themes in young adult can include any issues, concerns or attitudes that young adults will relate to. And young adult readers are exploring their identity and making up their minds about the world and their place in it. But I'll speak about cultural concerns tonight. Many people remain within their safe boundaries and in cultural boundaries. I know I did, but living in the Middle East for 10 years ripped me from my monocultural cocoon. I crossed so many borders besides physical ones, language, dress, customs, food. I saw people there too who were locked into their own cultural boundaries. But I guess I'd like young adult readers to think about the boundaries that may confine them rather than thoughtlessly living within them. Some boundaries can be safe and good, but some can exclude others. Since I experienced the displacement that comes from crossing cultural boundaries, not only in Pakistan and the United Arab Emirates, where I also lived, but in changing states when I was 14. And I guess living in Pakistan made me begin writing. Much of my fiction shows this displacement that comes when a border is crossed. With Jennifer in Zenadere, it was a move from city to Kapunda, which what I did. In Kaz, in the last virgin in year 10, decides to cross the border of the school culture to be herself. As in Saraya, the storyteller, it was a journey from war-torn Afghanistan to Australia as an asylum seeker. She finally breaks through the boundary of fear and distrust that Australians in her suburb had built up around themselves. A year 10 reviewer of Saraya, the storyteller, said she hadn't believed before that a book could change a reader's opinion like Saraya the storyteller had for her about asylum seekers. And Amira, in Marrying Amira, she crosses a cultural border when she refuses an arranged marriage. Arranged marriages actually work very well. My eldest daughter would have most probably said, you know, she said one day, "Oh, that's all right, Mum, you can arrange marriage, just ask me first, you know." That's what Dad said too about turning off the machine. There were variations on the theme in Pakistan. Ideally, marriages were arranged between families with similar educational, social, economic backgrounds. An abuse of the system occurs, though, when young people are forced to marry when they haven't given their consent. There's a law against this now in Pakistan since 2007, but it still occurs. And in many areas of Pakistan, there's a clan or cultural honour system where a family is shamed if a girl doesn't obey her parents or does something that they consider immoral. So there is sometimes a lot of emotional, psychological or even physical pressure to marry the family's choice. Every year, the forced marriage unit in Britain has thousands of inquiries and saves 300 people from forced marriages. About a third are under 18, some as young as 8, and 15% of cases involve young men. In 2007, the British forced marriage unit in Islamabad rescued 131 girls from forced marriages. And in Australia, in 2005, tough laws were introduced to prevent young people being sent abroad to engage in forced marriages. Just recently, a 16-year-old girl contacted police to be put on the airport watch because she didn't want to go to Lebanon for a marriage. So there are things they can do now. So many choices are made when writing a novel for young adults. One for me was to decide whether I, as a non-Muslim, could ethically cross a boundary for my faith and culture to tell Saraya's or Amira's story. Author and academic Eva Salas points out that discomfort with lack of authenticity and lack of authority could easily dominate a readership which searches too rigidly for one's right to write. I decided the research I'd taken, plus 7 years of living in Pakistan and 10 altogether in the Middle East, would suffice, along with Amira's mixed parentage. It can be beneficial to have a distance of observation, though, and I read this in Inez Barone's paper on writing self, character and the other. Empathy and intimacy are two types of inquiry into the other. Having empathy and having the distance that comes from not being a member of whatever group can be a powerful tool for observing. And that was encouraging for me because even though Amira has an Australian mother, I was concerned about the authority that some readers might believe an author should possess. And also encouraging is this message from a Muslim teenager. "Marrying Amira is a truly life-changing read," she wrote to me. "A perfect depiction of the Pakistani culture and all other attributes of a Pakistani-Australian teenage girl." And that girl said she was surprised her name wasn't on the cover. And these are just some of the wow moments that writers might get. More wisdom from Eva Salas. "To realise our cultural others requires that we live behind the context and the slang and beyond ourselves. We must become the observer from within." Writing across a cultural border, for me, demands more than getting the setting or cultural details right. To write Amira's anguish, I needed to feel her pain in wanting to marry for love, while understanding that this view isn't considered a Pakistani value. Even though I try to honestly record what I see, I was concerned lest my worldview sneak in under Amira's. But I decided that any mistakes she makes could be blamed on her mother, who isn't Muslim. And certainly Amira's cousin Haider in Pakistan contributes her Westernness to her Christian mother and therefore a Kutcher upbringing. Above all, Amira's story had to be paramount. The research would not allow the story to be believable if it interfered with the fiction. But I hope it served the story, as I tried to do, to coin a phrase from author Madeline L'Engle. Over 2 years, I developed the characters and plot line using my creative journal and mind maps, which is the way I do this, writing, selecting and rewriting the story with layers of cultural nuances like whitewash. One of the elements that I think has to really work well in young adult fiction is the voice. It took some time for Amira's voice to come to me. I couldn't start without it, so I experimented with both third person and first person by having her write in that creative journal. I knew Amira didn't have a slangy, upbeat Aussie voice. Her voice would be her own, the product of her upbringing in a mixed marriage in a host culture that neither of her parents totally embraced, her father least of all. And most of her friends are from minority groups as well. She knows a little bit of Urdu, but not enough to feel at home in Pakistan. And when her voice finally appeared on the page, and I don't know how this happens except to work at knowing the characters so well that they will define everything voice, plot, even structure. Then I decided to write a mirror story in first person, and in so doing the text engages with the sympathies of many of the other characters as well. I don't think we should ever underestimate the maturity and discernment of young adult readers and what they can handle. My work in progress, Mountain Wolf, tells the story of 14-year-old Rizak from tribal Pakistan who's sold into slavery. The themes of trafficking and abuse in this story, as well as the marriage and rape scene in Marrying a Mirror, enable the novels to fit easily within the more challenging contemporary writing in the field. The rape is the ultimate betrayal for Amira, who has been brought up to value virginity. In every way she is forced. When she dons the burqa her husband insists she wear, she watches herself vanish. She thinks at that time, I've disappeared in so many ways since I left home. This is just one more. The rape is the symbol of all that is taken from her, and so in a creative and narrative sense, the story demands it. I tried to avoid it, but then realised I had no choice either. This is what happens to Amira, and has probably happened to other forced brides, even though they rarely admit it. And in all the interviews that I saw, not one girl admitted having anything to do with the man that she had to marry. I wanted to write this story for the young adult market, because it's young adult girls and boys that it happens to. Writing a story and giving young adults a voice can help borders be crossed for young adult readers when they're needed, as well as to enrich and entertain. I write for character in the story, writing what I see, and yet I hope there's value in the story too. And I believe young adult literature is hopeful. Some people might disagree with that. Many novels deal with stark reality. I just read Vicky Wakefield's All I Ever Wanted, her new novel. It's brilliant. And that has stark reality. But we're with characters dealing with hardships. But the characters grow, come to a deeper understanding of self and human nature through the difficult circumstances they may be facing. So if our stories bring courage for young adult readers to learn more of the human spirit, to appreciate the beauty and flaws, and decide what they might like to improve in the world, then that could possibly mean that young adult authors are culture shapers. Thank you. And please, please remember to keep your questions to the end. Thank you.
Well, before I even got here today, I had to cross a boundary of my own. My car broke down on North Terrace. It's still there. I walked here. I felt like I had crossed a whole new country just to get here. But to get to the topic at hand, what I have always loved about young adult fiction, first as a reader and then as a writer, is that its protagonists are standing on the threshold of adulthood, moving from childhood to adulthood. My favourite young adult novels, which are books like Melina Marchetta's Saving Francesca and Joanne Horniman's Mahalia, Kate DeGoldie's Sanctuary, and I would also mention Vicky Wakefield's book as well here, are coming-of-age novels in which the protagonists, faced with certain situations or crises, have to make decisions and choices that determine who they will be for the rest of their lives. Amira is in a similar situation there, I think. It's that moment in our lives, the moment when each of us takes a step forward, away from childhood, along the path that will lead us to adulthood and to the people we will ultimately become. That's the moment that young adult novels seize and capture and make their own. And that, for me, is one of the boundaries the best young adult novels cross, the boundary between childhood and adulthood, between youth and maturity. I should add here that Malcolm will be taking a slightly different perspective, I believe, on this. He will, as you'll find out, explore the fluidity inherent in the process of growing up and the way adolescents move back and forth between adolescence and maturity. Nonetheless, I think that he, like all of us, would agree that there are particular moments when kids cross over into adulthood, even if they move back again for a while afterwards. And it's those moments I'll be exploring today, those moments of crossing the boundary between childhood and adulthood. One of the first experiences, of course, that most people will name as being the beginning of their journey across the boundary between childhood and adulthood is the experience of falling in love for the first time. As children, we know love to be the feeling that, hopefully, our parents have for us and that we have for them. We know that romantic love exists because we see it every day, on TV, perhaps displayed by our parents or our older siblings, or at the movies, or in books. But as kids, we laugh at that feeling. I remember declaring as a child that I would never get all gushy and kissy-kissy. Love and sex and kissing and fooling around seemed like foreign, slightly disgusting and certainly rather absurd concepts. But then we hit adolescence and it happens to us. We get a crush on a movie star or a teacher or someone in our class. And then somewhere along the line, we meet someone special. Friendship isn't enough anymore when it comes to that someone special. We long to do all those things we thought were foreign, disgusting and absurd with them. Love and sex and kissing and fooling around. And then one day we do those things, and for most of us, there's no looking back. Once you've experienced those feelings, you want them again, no matter what. And you wake up one morning and you realise that you are no longer a kid. You're an adult, at least in the sense that now you have adult longings and desires. You have crossed over the boundary between childhood and adulthood. The journey has begun. Young adult books, I think, describe exactly this. They describe those moments we can never repeat once we've had them. Our first kiss, our first touch, our first time, so to speak, tactfully or not. That's what I love about them. I love the way young adult books capture and hold on to that moment, the moment of the boundary crossing, in a way that you can't do in real life. They allow you to relive that moment and explore it and revisit it as often as you like and however old you are, if only real life was like that. In Beyond Evie, my second young adult novel, I chose to describe a particular kind of coming of age, a particular experience of falling in love and crossing over from childhood to maturity. The narrator in my book, Charlotte, is 16 when she meets and becomes friends with another girl of her own age, Evie. Evie's like no one else Charlotte has ever met. She wears mismatched op-shop clothes, a bit like me sometimes, and smokes cigarettes and tells Charlotte she was expelled from her last school for smoking dope. Whether that's true or not, Charlotte never actually finds out. Evie is gifted artistically. She likes to take photographs of people, but not landscapes, and she sketches and paints too. She sleeps around, or so at least she hints to Charlotte. She makes promises that she doesn't keep. She even steals things. One day she steals a gold necklace from a department store they've just been to and gives it as a gift to Charlotte. When Charlotte protests, shocked, Evie says, "Why pay for something when you can take it for free? Anyway, it's much more exciting this way, right? I bet no one's ever stolen something for you before." And somehow Charlotte moves from being shocked to being flattered. It's true, she thinks, no one has ever stolen anything for her before. You can probably guess by now where this is going. Evie is what my grandmother would have called bad news. She's dishonest and she exploits Charlotte for her own uses. But Charlotte is dazzled by her. She's entranced. She's confused. Slowly, or so it seems to her, though the actual story takes place over only 4 months, Charlotte realises she is falling in love with Evie. What she doesn't know is whether Evie loves her back. And I'm not going to tell you, you'll have to read the book to find out. I started by saying that what I love about young adult books is that they describe that time in our lives when we cross over from childhood to adulthood, and that is what Beyond Evie is about, in part. But in part, it's about something else too. The world that Charlotte lives in, today's world, the world of the 21st century, is not the world that I, or most of you in the audience, grew up in. When I was a teenager, there were very few books for young adults that explored love or attraction or sex between people of the same sex. And when they did explore that theme, and I'm thinking of books like John Donovan's I'll Get There, It Better Be Worth the Wait, or Nancy Garden's Annie on My Mind, these were books about teens who were coming out of the closet. Do you remember that expression? Those books explored the fear that their protagonists felt at being discriminated against. They explored the shame their protagonists felt for loving people of their own gender rather than of the opposite gender. The overarching theme in these books, the message to their largely teenage audience, was it's okay to be gay. They crossed almost insurmountable boundaries, those books. They moved their readers from a world of suspicion and prejudice about homosexuality to a world where homosexuality was acceptable in its own right and as its own identity. But that is not what Beyond Evie is about. If you read Beyond Evie, you won't find the word gay anywhere in the text. You won't find lesbian or bisexual or even straight either. And you won't read about Charlotte agonising over her attraction to another girl or about her ultimate decision to come out. You won't find these things because the world that Charlotte lives in, today's world, the 21st century, has, I believe, moved beyond these notions. Young people in today's world don't see the world in labels as you and I might have done. They see sexuality as a far more fluid thing, a thing, if you like, that is without boundaries. There was a series on TV at the beginning of the last decade which was immensely popular amongst young people. Some of you may have watched it. It was called The Secret Life of Us, and it was about the day-to-day lives of a group of young adults, they were 20-somethings rather than teens, who were living in Sydney. These young people lived and worked and partied and went broke and lost their jobs and had sex and fell in and out of love and got drunk and basically did what young people do. One of the characters, a girl, in a later episode fell in love with another girl. She'd previously been dating a boy. When her friends asked, "So does that mean you're, you know, gay?" she said, "I'm not gay. I just happen to be in love with a girl right now." That's the world young people live in right now. That's the world I wanted to describe in Beyond Evie. I was fascinated by the idea of exploration and of adolescence as a time of exploration. I was fascinated by the concept of a world where a girl might fall in love with a boy and then with a girl and then with a boy again, and see that, all of that, as a part of exploring, learning who she is, where she fits in the world, rather than as a question of her sexual identity. That's a boundary I hadn't seen crossed in young adult fiction before, the description of adolescent love as an exploration rather than as a label of sexual identity. Interestingly enough, the girl that Charlotte falls for is, as we have seen, not a very nice girl. She's a minx, as one of my radio interviewers once described her to me. She kisses Charlotte, but then she pulls away. She teases Charlotte and makes fun of her, and then she kisses her again. She taunts Charlotte, and then tells Charlotte she's beautiful. In other words, she manipulates Charlotte constantly. And Charlotte's response is utter confusion and bewilderment. She wonders if Evie likes her or loves her or is attracted to her or hates her. And in her confusion, what Charlotte tries to do is what we all try to do when we're experiencing unrequited love. She tries to identify Evie's feelings for her. She tries to label Evie's feelings, to categorise them. If she just knows how Evie really feels for her, she thinks she'll be okay. She'll understand where she is. And here is the paradox. Charlotte lives in a fluid world. She doesn't see sexuality as a fixed concept. She doesn't care if the object of her affection is male or female. But she still wants boundaries. She still needs to know where she stands with Evie. She needs some sense of stability. She needs something or someone to hold on to and trust, which is not something it seems Evie is willing to give to her. This is what I found out when I wrote Beyond Evie. I was writing about a fluid world, a world without boundaries, and yet I found that the young people living in that world still needed some sense of boundary, some limits, some endpoint or reference point to make sense of themselves. You can't be completely fluid after all, or so it seems. But that kind of brings me back to the point I started with. What I most love about young adult fiction is that it describes the moment we cross over the boundary between childhood and adulthood. And that still holds, even in Charlotte's and Evie's world. Charlotte is still standing at that threshold between childhood and adulthood. Her experience with Evie moves her closer to making that final step towards adulthood. Even though she lives in a world far more fluid and less filled with labels and expectations, the one that you and I grew up in, she still has that threshold to cross. She may not need to come out, but she certainly needs to come of age. Her experience is, in that sense, universal. When Evie says to her, "I'm not like you, Charlotte, I'm just not that into girls," Charlotte thinks, "But you're wrong, that's the thing. It was you I was into, Evie, just you." Isn't that what unrequited love is all about? Don't we all, in order to become adults, have to experience this at least once in our lives, whether we have feelings for someone of the same sex or the opposite? Maybe it's a pivotal threshold we just have to cross in order to reach maturity. So it seems to me that no matter how much the world changes, no matter how much freer it may get, young adult literature will still remain relevant. All of us at some point have to move from childhood to adulthood. If we can do so accompanied by great young adult books, I believe we will be all the richer for the experience. Thank you.
Look, thank you for sacrificing the tail end of the day, a beautiful day, wonderful day, coming along to hear all three of us speak. Rebecca's and Roseanne's books, the ones that I've read, I would sort of classify as social realism. I write in a slightly different mode. I write what I call, and feel free to laugh here, realist fantasy. Now, I know you're probably screaming oxymoron, which it is, but such a term would not be lost on your average teenager. They understand it immediately. They live in that world, a world where demanding money with menaces sits quite comfortably alongside motivational paralysis with regards to dishwashing and lawn mowing. No, rather than an oxymoron, I see the term realist fantasy is in itself a border country, bandit country. where you can be ambushed anytime, a liminal space, hovering and waiting for somebody to enter. Now, 90% of the stone crown is set in the real world, the Scottish borders, with contemporary teenage protagonists dealing with the usual teenage issues. However, I didn't choose the Scottish borders because I think that's where Arthur almost certainly ran his campaign against the boat people, the Angles and Saxons, but precisely because it's a boundary, a border. And as such, it can be read as a metaphor for much of the story that I've written. So The Stone Crown is perhaps a novel less about place and more about finding one's place. And adolescence is often about location and dislocation, the discomfort of moving between two worlds. But David Malouf once said, and I feel a bit odd quoting Malouf because we write for youngsters and he writes for real people, adults. Well, not that our audience isn't real, but you know what I'm saying. He said once, if you live in a little village in England or Ireland, you can comfortably tell yourself that you absolutely belong in that landscape, and there is no problem, there is no metaphysical problem. Take the same people out and put them somewhere where all of those things are gone, and then yes, they are in a kind of void. And this opens up the question of what it is we need as humans to place ourselves in the world and how difficult it is to achieve that. Not surprisingly, Malouf's comments apply equally to teenagers. They're moving from the old world to the new, and Beck has partially addressed this. They're being asked to relinquish childhood, the traditional site of fantasy, and enter the real world. They are in, I suppose you could say, border country. And you only have to read the statistics on youth suicide to know that this really is bandit country for some people. This is why I choose to write in this mode rather than realism. Because while on many levels teenagers appear all too eager to throw off the shackles of parental authority, we all know that many of them, in fact many adults, still cling unreasonably, unscientifically to fantasy and childhood. I'm one of them. And the adult readers of Harry Potter and J.K. Rowling's bank balance attest to this. And I'm using the term bank balance rather loosely here because I think Rowling's finances have probably more in common with a black hole than any notion of balance. She probably owns several banks, but envy is a whole other story and we're not going there tonight, okay? Canadian academic Brian Atterbury has a much better term than the one that I use, realist fantasy. Instead, he calls this kind of narrative ploy Indigenous fantasy. Now, I don't mean Indigenous with a capital I, as in, you know, blackfellas. I'm talking about a mode where the action takes place in what he describes as the ordinary world, contrary to all sensory evidence and experience, magical beings and supernatural forces are to be found. Now, our post-Enlightenment scientific rationalist and heavily materialist culture sees magic and the supernatural as more a problem of medieval thinking. However, in high fantasy, fantasy that involves a secondary world often populated by mythical creatures, the landscape and culture are quite commonly medieval. And the Middle Ages can double very nicely as a metaphor for adolescent experience. Now, this is not my idea. This is the idea of a man called Paul Hardwick. And he suggests that the most effective adolescent fiction confronts the reader with his or her own Middle Ages in the sense that it is a period of blurred boundaries and barely suppressed violence of one kind or another, which in part, I suppose, explains the ongoing durability and popularity among adolescents and adults of much Tolkienian fantasy. But fantasy serves, for me, a dual purpose. The fantasy landscape of popular fiction is at once an escape hatch from the pressures of social pressures of family and school, and at the same time a parallel world of problems and problem solving and solutions. I think Indigenous fantasy perhaps even more so. And as a writer, this melding of real and fantasy worlds allows me more freedom. What would have perhaps been in your face mimesis can now be disguised in other ways. In the Stone Crown, Merlin impregnates the 12-year-old Arthur with the oak god, the spirit of the forest, and in so doing, turns him into this uncontrollable, violent and merciless killer who must be entrapped and controlled at all costs. I mean, I know some parents would like to do that to their teenagers, but that's a whole other story. An academic from this university wrote an article on the Stone Crown, which was published in Symbiosis, the Journal of Anglo and American Literary Relations, in which she drew a parallel between the ongoing trauma in the book of Arthur's time-trapped knights and the mental and emotional gymnastics of the lead characters, and then turned it around and linked this to Vietnam veterans and post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, this was very gratifying for me. She seemed to have completely understood what I was trying to do, because adolescence can be both traumatic and stressful, and you get spots as well. Which is why I simply cannot write escapist, you know, traditional secondary world escapist fantasy. Lots of people can. I've nothing against it. I read and have read plenty of escapist literature in my time and thoroughly enjoyed it. But the books that stick, the books that I remember, always have an edge. They take me to places that are not necessarily comfortable, whether fantasy or realism. And in so doing, pose once again Malouf's question, what is it that makes us human? Or questions, I should say, perhaps. How do we place ourselves in a landscape, whether political, social or cultural? Which kind of brings me to the crux of what I'm going on about. The thought police, or what I sometimes term your politically correctional services, would have us all neatly packaged, us authors, beavering away on issues-based manuscripts that don't cross any lines, because the lines have already been drawn, lines that want to contain and position narrative in neatly digestible, inoffensive packages. I have nothing against issue-based books. There are some absolute crackers out there. Some very, very fine examples. Nor am I suggesting that all YA literature should be dark, nihilistic, or negative. I mean, Roseanne spoke about hope, and I think there has to be hope in most teenage writing. There's plenty of room out there for everything. But boundaries are there to be crossed, and I know that these authors have certainly crossed boundaries in their works. Now, as a child, I was inordinately fond of the classic The Wind in the Willows. I still am. I hope, beyond hope, it continues to be read by children. But given the recent events in the UK, I would be either blind or stupid to think that the writing youths that I saw on TV, if they did in fact read at all, would be interested in reading Kenneth Graham. I think not. And this poses a tricky question, one that I can sum up in two phrases: old fart and street cred. Your average teenager is hardly going to see a middle-aged, follically challenged geezer such as myself. And these are Ian Bone's words spoken in this very room when he launched my book, and he was talking about both of us. Well, perhaps he was just talking about himself. I mean. Yes, I mean, my street cred is more likely to be seen as street deb, and that's debit rather than debutante. And that's fine by me, it frees me up. I'm probably going to write what I want to write anyway. I'm going to write what interests me. And for me, that's all about crossing boundaries, matching up the tricky taboo areas that our two speakers have been talking about, those issues facing all of us, not just teenagers, with other non-rational explorations of the world we inhabit, which lends itself to the whole fantasy genre. Teenagers. Who knows what they want? But we're going to give them it anyway, because we're authors and we're in a position of power, I suppose. I believe that those who aren't Facebooking want to read narratives that challenge, intrigue, and question their place in the world. They challenge the hegemony, if you like, of adulthood. Books that take them into the wild world of the borders. Not necessarily the Scottish borders, any kind of borders, any boundaries. Could be Pakistan, it could be Jetty Road. Any border, but there are borders within the fiction that we all write. Books that speak back to them from that space, not in a way that preaches at them through politically correct sermons, but mysteriously and enigmatically. And I know that both Beck and Roseanne do this very well. Books that pose as many questions as they do answers. Now, we're in the academy, right? We're safe, hallowed halls and all that. No, don't think for one minute that literature with a capital L is safe. Gone are the days when eight-year-olds were weaned on the classics or the canon. These days, and having taught here, Dylan won't even be Bob, let alone Thomas. Big Brother isn't room 101 anymore, and Dickens is more likely to elicit that archetypal adolescent response, what the Dickens, or what the fuck. As children's and YA authors, we're in the front line when it comes to educating tomorrow's readers. If we, in the academy, or anybody, wants our kids to graduate to Shakespeare and Dickens, Wolfe and Eliot, Lessing and Golding. When I wrote this, I just suddenly realised how Anglophone I am. Sorry, I should have chucked some Australians in there. These are the people that came to mind, sorry. If we want them to read at all, in fact, they've got to start somewhere. And ours may just be the book that they pick up. And if they do, if they pick up my book, I'd like to think it's not some prepackaged, patronising, politically correct view of the world that I'm offering. Along with The Wind in the Willows, I want books with teeth, books that bite back, and I'm not talking about the current crop of vampire stuff that seems to have taken over and dominate all of the bookshelves out there. I'm talking about YA fiction that drops our teeners at that isolated frontier crossing post, boom boom, hands them their black market passports with the forged visa and says, here be dragons, or more to the point, here be drug lords, dope dealers and danger. I'd like to think that when I write, I'm saying over here is my version of reality, however fantastic or weird that might be, step into it if you dare. Because as a writer, I'm not necessarily interested in making it a comfortable ride.